This is Snobs on Film.
I think you owe me, after this many pretty goddamn good years of marriage, a solid reason. I worked my ass off to make enough money to provide you with a good life. And you owe me a reason that makes sense. So let's hear it. Come on. Let's hear it. Let's hear it.
Because when I watch you eat, when I see you asleep, when I look at you lately, I just want to smash your face in.
Come on, smash my face. Come on, you want to smash my face? The next time I hit back, and you better get yourself a damn good lawyer.
Best your money can buy.
Snobs on Film. My name is Arthur, and I am joined by my co-hosts Aiko, Isaac, and Jahan. Let's talk about The War of the Roses, an 80s movie that shows just how far two people will go when what starts out as the perfect marriage ends up in the ugliest of divorces. So, this is a film that reunites Michael Douglas and Kathleen Turner, who star as Oliver Rose and Barbara Rose, respectively, with Danny DeVito, who also directed. The three had previously worked together in Romancing the Stone, and its sequel, Jewel of the Nile, which are completely different films than what we're talking about today. The War of the Roses traces the arc of Oliver and Barbara's life together, from its sweet beginnings to its bitter, bitter end. And as their love dissipates, we watch them gradually begin to despise each other, and they eventually turn their family home into a final battleground. Roses flirts with comedic rage and cartoon-like violence, but it's clear that the movie has something serious to say about the consequences of vengeance and vendettas. And as we watch Oliver and Barbara engage in toxic rivalry and domestic warfare, the film shows us what divorce looks like when the opposite of love turns out not to be indifference, but instead transforms into uncontrollable hate. So, War of the Roses. Episode 3 in our Strange Love series, where we talk about situations of strange love, be it like this, when love turns to hate, or other things when it's just a totally bad idea, girl, you need to run, or things that just don't even make sense on paper. So let's start out with the obvious question. Who is this love between? Who's this strange love between?
Oliver and Gavin.
Okay, that's a twist. But you know, I usually go with the obvious thing and say, okay, well, you know, I mean, the love has to be between Barbara and Oliver because obviously they're married, it's the roses and all that. But I'm going to take the unconventional turn and actually say that the love is between Barbara and Oliver, but Barbara to her desire to be right, be the winner, and Oliver's desire for the same thing, to be right, to be the winner. This adversarial love to best their opponent.
I was going to say the roses in the house.
The house is just a token, a tool, right? I mean, it's just a representative of what they, you know, it matters more to her, I think.
Well, him too, because he won't leave.
Yeah, but I think his motivation to keep the house was just so she wouldn't have it. I think her motivation was because she had poured 18 years of whatever into it.
No, definitely. I'm actually joking. I don't think the strange love is between them in the house.
But you know what would have been a good subplot, though? It would have been a strange love between... Because what's his face? Gavin is kind of presented early as a not a degenerate, but kind of a, you know.
Yeah.
Not even a pervert, but just someone who just really is just all about sex to him. He's kind of seedy at first, and then they kind of go away from that.
He's
they don't do anything with that. Yeah, he's a hedonist, exactly. But then it would have been really sweet to see something develop between him and what was the live-in housekeeper's name? I forgot her name, but she was really... She had a really sweet spirit.
I do agree with you. I think the other thing is that in the beginning, he's somewhat of an unreliable narrator, because like he's telling the story to this potential client about the Battle of the Roses, but he's totally like, yeah, and everything was great. And I'm like, everything wasn't great. Like from jump, you could see the little cracks in, you know, in the wall. And he's just like, twice he says it. And then he says, finally, yeah. And then shit hit the fan. It's like, nah, dude, like, they were crazy from, you caught it early.
Mm-hmm. They had that good first night, right? the day they met, that was a good time.
That's probably quite realistic though, because how many couples do you know where they split up and everybody around them is like, oh, wow, I never knew that there was any problems. I never knew that there was any drama. It's probably quite realistic, right?
Yeah.
Because unless you're part of something, unless you're actually inside something, you don't really know what's going on. You don't really have a clue. Especially, and this goes to your question about the strange love and who it was between, especially, and I'm talking about Douglas's character here, especially for people for whom presentation of perfection and the perception of perfection is very important.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
So, you know, I think he definitely loved her, but I think he also loved being perceived as somebody who was successful in every area, including his marriage. But other than that, I think the strange love was pretty nuts and bolts. I think it was two people who came together passionately and thought they were on the same page, but they weren't from the beginning. You know, as it is with many relationships, they didn't really dig deep in the beginning. I don't think they really wanted to uncover anything that might not be to their liking. And then the rest of it is just natural. You know, as time goes on, people grow in different directions and they reveal themselves to be things that you may like both more and less. And, you know,
that's
just definitely the way of the world, right?
I saw Oliver's desire to uphold this image that John was talking about. I'll say that it's an unintended consequence because I think Oliver had this vision of what homegirl's role was to be, what Barbara's role was to be as his wife, as maybe a few notches above a trophy wife. But it was subjugating because she had not just dreams, she actually had, you know, a business plan, business ideas. She was intelligent herself. She was credentialed herself. And Oliver always forced her to take a back seat to his desires, and he would do it in such a way where he would need to make her feel small. And the funniest thing about this film to me was, and the thing that was so obvious, was that as they became really adversaries going into this divorce, that Oliver never had any imagination, in that he never thought Barbara would go that far. Like whatever he did to hurt her, she would up it. You know what I mean? She would she would see him and raise him 5,000.
Yeah.
And on the flip side of that, and I think this is very common in most relationships, particularly between men and women, a lot of times a guy will underestimate how they can turn back the clock, or rather they will overestimate how much they can turn back the clock and how much latitude they have.
You mean like, let's start over or let's dial it back?
Yeah, like, you know, we haven't gone too far. We haven't reached the point of no return. You don't really mean this. Give me one more chance, you know, like that.
Mm-hmm. It's like once you lose respect and then once the whole, like you're sitting across from somebody and you hate the way they chew, it's a wrap.
That phrase she said later in the movie where, you know, I see you and I just want to smash your face. I've heard that from women, you know, not to me, of course, but I've heard that from women in divorce. I've heard them say that about the person they're divorcing. Mm-hmm. I literally just heard that like 4 days ago from a woman who's going through a divorce, and she was trying to, and she and I don't know each other very, you know, we're not super close, but I know her, and she was explaining what she's going through, her divorce. And she was trying to articulate just how much she can't stand him. And that's the phrase she used. She said, every time I see him, I want to just smash his face. And I was like, so when I saw it in the movie last night, I was like, wow.
In that scene, especially, I mean, throughout the movie, but in that scene, especially, didn't Douglas do a wonderful job of having a really smashable face with his expressions and everything?
Yes,
he did.
It's kind of cool, right? Because unlike a lot of the other Hollywood matinee idols like Harrison Ford, etc., from the 80s, Douglas hasn't been afraid to choose roles which have a little bit more of a kind of 360 span of emotion with both a negative side and a positive side. And, you know, he hasn't been afraid to choose characters that believe their own hype or are a bit of a jackass. And, I mean, he really reveled in this one. He really went all the way with it. And I thought, good for you.
You know, that part of it, because I agree with you, he did. He had this certain type of Michael Douglas smugness that it played, and he has it in a lot of roles, because if you look at, like Arthur mentioned in his opening, if you look at Romancing the Stone, he's smug in that movie, but it's a very charming, it ends up being a charming Jack, you're so smug, kind of funny smugness. Whereas in this movie, it was like, this motherfucker is an
asshole. In Romancing the Stone, he delivers on the smugness, right?
Yeah.
He
Black
does.
Rain, he delivers on the smugness. Wall Street, same deal. Black delivers Rain. On it.
Released in the same year. So you figure he's doing these two very different characters in the same space. Yeah.
So to your point, there's 2 points. To your point, one about the smash your face. Yes, she was justified in her anger towards him, but she's the one who took it up a notch and took it to the next. She was the one that got physical with him. Like, he was never going to haul off and just hit her or anything like that. She was the one that just honestly started beating his ass. For me, it's a little disturbing just because, you know, I feel like violence is necessary, but it's necessary when it's necessary. If you're really pissed off at somebody, I don't honestly feel that you should ever just haul off and smack somebody, especially because of the fact that you don't know what kind of man you're dealing with.
On the point of the punch and on the point of the divorce, etc., my only sort of criticism, I guess, is there's no point where she comes to him before it reaches that kind of FIFA pitch and says, listen, look, I'm not happy.
Bingo.
So it kind of goes from you're a constant irritation or an increasing irritation to I don't even care if you were going to die. And that strikes me as a bit of it's a lot of real estate to travel across. But I guess maybe I should backtrack, actually, because now that I think about it, she does have that speech where she sort of reveals to him that, look, when you were on your way to the hospital and we didn't know whether you were going to live or die, I felt relief and I felt released. So maybe it wasn't even clear to her. Maybe she was only just kind of realizing, and she'd maybe buried her feelings in this kind of perfect, on the surface, perfect family kind of vibe. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't think you are. Can I throw something in real quick though? I would just say that in the ideally what you're saying is 100% correct. Like, she should have came, but I think in the real world, we all know when in male female relationships, or I guess in female female or whatever relationships, if you are in a relationship with a woman, attentiveness is like right at the top, and you have to read between lines. You have to pay attention. And she was giving him all types of signs that she was not happy. Mm-hmm. She did not explicitly say it, but we all know that that's, and you know, as messed up as it is, she should have said it. But we know there's a lot of times women don't say it, and you have to look and you have to watch, and you have to see what's going on. So I agree with you. She should have said it, but she didn't say it. And we were as people looking in through the window, we could see it. Like, this broad is not happy. You know what I'm saying? She's going to leave his ass. But yeah, you're right. It was kind of like a train hit him when she didn't come to the hospital. And he's like, what the fuck? You know, what's going on? And she was like, that was probably my favorite scene in the movie. I didn't really love this movie, but that was a really good scene when she said to him, I was happy, you know, relieved, you know, that when I thought you were dead. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, now that I think about it, it's completely true that so many people don't know what they're feeling when they're feeling it. And people don't know how to interpret their emotions. You know, we have an entire industry of psychology dedicated to that, especially if you buy into, as I do, the foundation of a family, of two people being together and building something. You know, when you put everything into something and you build it and it becomes realized, and then it slowly starts to turn into a bit of a nightmare, it's probably very hard to take. And it may be very hard to face that. So I quite like the idea that she was working it out in real time for herself.
I think you guys are both right. And I think, Jahan, the point that you've made a couple of times is that basically that dynamic is very, unfortunately, very normal in relationships. But I do agree that I don't think that she voiced anything, because the problem with both of them and with her as well is that she never communicated her needs. And so if you base a relationship, number one, on multiple orgasms, and then, you know, you've got whatever
it is.
And
what's wrong with that? I'm just
listen,
kidding.
Listen, it's great. But you don't base a marriage and have kids on multiple orgasms. Nobody, you could tell that they never had sat down and had a conversation about what their, what anyone's goals were, what she saw for herself, what he saw for himself, what that looked like. They didn't have a discussion on how many treats the kids could have after dinner. None of it. Like, so basically, they're just you know what I mean? Like, they're learning as they're going along. And then, like you said, Jahan, you wake up one day and you're like, oh shit, this isn't the relationship I wanted. But they also didn't take responsibility for the roles that they played in it in order to get where they were. So I do think that, like, and I'm sorry, but just like hauling off and smacking somebody, I just, that shit I don't like. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. She didn't, no, she didn't smack him. She hit him. That wasn't a smack. That was a closed fist.
Which is crazy because she wasn't even in the right stance. Yeah. I mean, it was a right-handed blow with her right hip and her right leg placed forward. I mean, who hits like that?
Did she hit him with a right? Because he was bleeding on his, wait a minute, he was bleeding on his right when she hit him.
Yeah, but it's a cross and she probably really curled
she
it.
She threw right. a copper pot at his back while he was standing in front of an oven. Granted, I understood that whole entire scene because I might have actually lost, I might have blacked out in that particular scene. Like, first of all, you gonna have me with my dinner, you're gonna contaminate the food, embarrass me in front of my dinner guests, and then go piss on the fish. You might have to fucking die. You might have to die. I understood the pot. It might have been a cast iron pan though, but I understood somebody's gonna get hurt in this situation. Like, from that right there, I was like, and he's like, oh, you know, now the gloves are off. Bitch, you pissed on the fish. Like, you're peeing in the fucking oven. Are you kidding me? Like, I would listen.
I mean, Danny DeVito's character gave him the best advice. He's like, you know, nobody wins in divorce. You know, you just sell the house. But you know, it, at that point for Michael Douglas, it was just, you know, the whole thing became, you know, attrition. It was like, I'm holding on to this to hurt her. You know, she's not going to win. Yeah, I may not win.
It was a last man standing kind of situation.
Yeah. I think that's the problem, right? It's like when you, I think we're probably turning this into a therapy session now.
It is a therapy session. The movie is.
But I think that's the problem. When the goal becomes a competition rather than the goal being happiness, and you measure your happiness by how unhappy the other person is. Because that's what a competition is. Yeah. You have a winner and you have a loser. Rather than just ask the simplest of questions, you know, what's actually best for this situation? And of course, more than anything, when children are involved, what's the best response to this for our children? And here's where I'll blame Douglas's character, because he's the one who instigated the competition. You know, he didn't want to let go. She was saying, can't you just leave?
Yeah.
Can't we just agree on terms?
Yeah.
Especially because what she was asking for wasn't necessarily out of whack with the area and a typical judgment.
Well, you know, one thing that I didn't like about this film.
So to be clear, am I the only one who really liked this movie? Am I the only one who saw it and said, I really liked it?
Well, no, actually, I mean, I liked it overall. But there was a situation where... And it has more to do with 80s films and just how the woman is portrayed. And what this brought out in me was, because I mean, when, you know, because Homegirl, Barbara really ratchets it like all the way up and not only meets him at his level of pettiness, but mines the depths of the petty well to really, I mean, like she's humiliating his dog for the only reason, the fact that she's a cat person, he's a dog person. That was a sign right there.
Right.
But, you know, she's humiliating his dog. You know, she's butchering, abusing his figurines that he so treasures, you know, and it becomes a tit for tat situation. And like Aika was pointing out, she's the one that actually raised it to the level of violence. And you know, a question that I have to you all is that once Barbara did that, did you almost reflexively say, oh, she's crazy?
Well, to answer your question, I don't agree with you. I never felt that Kathleen Turner was worse than him in this movie. The only thing that she was worse at, and I use worse here with huge inverted commas, like huge speech marks. Mm-hmm. But the only thing that I think she was worse at is in his own stupid, broken, incompetent way, he was still trying to work on a resolution. He was still trying to say, look, can't we make this work? And she wasn't, and of course that's her right. But I think the only thing that she did to him that was worse than him was in the stakes of the competition of who's going to win, who's going to lose, was giving her lawyer his dying declaration.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That said, all I am is because of you, and all I have is yours. And she's contrite about that, right? I mean, she says to her lawyer, dude, I didn't know you were going to show that to him. How could you do that? And not that I'm an apologist for her murderous intent, but the occasions where she tries to kill him, you know, the hammering him into the sauna, driving over him in his car or with her car, it's always a reaction. It's a reaction to, you killed my pet. It's a reaction to, you've deliberately gone out of your way to humiliate me and embarrass me. You know, emotions are running high, etc. I'm not saying it's okay. I'm just saying it's important, I think, to check the context of the reaction. And then, of course, the performances, the acting performances that show you where the character's mind states are. Like when you have Douglas's performance, there's a certain glee to his actions. When he's enjoying it. When you have Turner's performance, there's a shock, there's a grief, there's a frustration. She says, why are you doing this to me?
Yeah. I think the part that really I thought was like, there's no coming back from this, is when she'd been trying to talk to him about her business plan, because she's truly a talented cook, like a chef, you know, and basically he put off actually reading it. And then he hit the fly with it and she had to clean it off. And to me, that right there was, I was like, that's for me, like, that would probably be a deal breaker. Not if it was early in the relationship, but the way it just, it was like the icing on the cake or whatever, where it's just like, yo, he doesn't see you. He's never going to see you. Like, who did you marry? Y'all, you guys are, you know, had your little competitive thing with the little piece that they wanted to buy at the auction. But it's just like, she was, you know, a fully realized person, you know, and granted, like, yeah, I'm going to help him build his empire. Everything he said in that letter was true. You wouldn't be able, and she said that to him in the car, you wouldn't have what you have if it wasn't for me and the sacrifices I've made for this family in order to prop you up to become what you want to become. And now that we've done this and these kids are a certain age or whatever, and I recognize the talent and I have these things that I want to do, you fucking take the very thing that's like my dream and say, you smash it with a fly. Man, fuck you. Like, it's a wrap.
Yeah, that was probably it. But let me ask you guys this though, because I think this, and I know we're off track, so I'll just say this really quickly, but this is the problem that I had with the violence, because how I was supposed to take the violence, because like everything Aiko just said, I agree with, because he's guilty of like gross neglect. Like like at that point when he did that with the contract, I was like, that's it. I had the same reaction. She's done. You know, that's it. And she had every right to walk away. She should have gotten the house, all that stuff. The problem that I have with the violence is that, because I didn't know how I was supposed to take it, because really he was guilty of gross neglect. She tried to murder him multiple times. And it's like Jay said, so it's like, if she was guilty of gross neglect and he tried to murder her, he'd be wrong. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, in the way the violence was played, it was almost played like, you know, we should be laughing at the chandelier about, she's about to drop a chandelier on him. And if you look at the punch, when she punched him, it was funny, because remember he was saying, like, you know, he was talking, he had that Michael Douglas smug look on his face, the camera was close on him and he was talking. So when she punched him, I laughed because it was a funny moment. A second later though, he looks at her dead serious. Next time I hit back, and suddenly all of a sudden the tone just shifted and it was like, okay, now I'm not laughing. And it was like, so I really didn't, I just, you know, it's just in my opinion, I don't think that they handled, and again, maybe it's because the 80s movie is out of context now. Yeah. The violence didn't really work for me in the movie, because I didn't know what I was supposed to be feeling. You know, it was like multiple times she tries to murder him. He almost, I'll tell you a scene that was, you know, when she goes down the steps, right? She falls down the steps. The next, or that night, she's laying in bed. Her whole side is bruised up. And it was like, okay, it was supposed to be funny when she was going down the steps. The next scene, that ain't funny. They deliberately showed you all the bruises up and down her side. She could have went to the police station and got him arrested right there, you know? Mm-hmm. So I just feel tonally, I don't think it worked for me.
Yeah, I mean, so if you hear Douglas or DeVito talking about this movie, both of them, I think, have said they wanted to make a movie where the audience wasn't sure how they should feel. Mm-hmm. They wanted to make a movie where the audience laughed and then checked themselves for laughing. Like, oh, wait, hang on, this is horrific. What am I laughing at? Mm-hmm. So that was their intent.
Mm.
You know, too often there are movies with all jokes, no stakes, or no jokes, high stakes. And I like that they merged the two. Mm-hmm. And it kind of makes the audience switch between, you know, schadenfreude, and actually feeling bad that they're laughing at these people.
Well, an inside kind of scoop to the film in the way that you guys and what you guys are just talking about is the production designer on the film is Ida Random, and she's done The Big Chill. What's the big Waterworld? She did that one. She's done a bunch of films in the industry. And in fact, Kevin Costner recently gave a big speech for her at an Academy event honoring her, saying that basically he wouldn't have the career if it wasn't for her, because she actually got him cast in something in order to get him speaking lines. And because of that, his career took off. And one of the things they said, there were two things that she said about the film. And one of them is that the Academy, they were set to get nominations, but because it hit a little too close to home, and the agents and all these other people basically saw their relationship on screen, decided to just kind of dead the film and not say anything. It was the subject was too touchy. So I thought that was really interesting. And then the second thing is that she said when she was designing the film, the house was supposed to look like a fairy tale. And if you see it, there's the soft lighting and the pinks and the, all these things. Like they, she purposely made it look like a fairy tale in order, from a creative standpoint. And it's the only film that she's ever done that Architectural Digest gave it a 2-page spread because they were so impressed with the way it looked. But she designed it in that way to kind of give off the thing of, like, again, what you guys are talking about, this perfect marriage is perfect, whatever. But everything behind the scenes is trash. But I just thought it was funny that all these agents and all these Academy members were like, we're not going to nominate it now because, you know, it's a little too close to home.
Yeah. And that's that, because I agree, Isaac, with the tonal that it had some difficulty with how you were supposed to feel. And it's in, and it is interesting to hear that, okay, that was in a kind of an intentional, it was intentional to do it that way.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I never thought that. So I, you know, I've had a front row seat to a divorce, and as a child, and while this was certainly exaggerated, the level of mind games in particular was like, oh yeah, that's spot on, that's real. You go after what the other person covets in order to hurt them. And that stings, or at least the sting is much longer lasting than a blow or a slap. But I still kind of believe that the way that Barbara's character was shifted once she really escalated it, I just felt like crazy is a label that could be easily applied to her. That kind of takes the steam out of, you know, out of her engine.
I kind of, you know, I have to agree with Jay in that. I didn't get crazy from her. If I got crazy, it's that they're both crazy, you know, because it really, at that point in the film, it was just like, again, like I said, it was like an act of attrition, you know, both of them just like, and one thing that hit me is like, I could, you know, and I identified more with him because he's a man. So it's like, I was like putting myself in his place more, obviously. And it's like some of his thinking, and, you know, again, some of the initial, you know, shock of her not coming to the hospital, the letter being brought out by the lawyer, you know, the dying declaration, the pain that must, how hurt he must have been. Some of his actions after that, I could forgive in a younger man, like, because in this film at the end, he's what, in his late 40s, 50s, I think, you know, he should have known at that point in life, it's better to be happy, you know, so he should have let go, you know, earlier than he did. When in the lawyer's office, when the lawyer brings out the act, you know, the dying declaration, I can absolutely understand Michael Douglas's reaction. I completely get, because that was just like a knife in the heart and then twisting it. I can understand his reaction. But then weeks later, months later, to me, he should have had the insight that Danny DeVito had and been like, you know what? F it. Let her have that. Let me move on with my life and find some happiness. The kids are grown. I ain't got to see this broad no more. You know what I'm saying? It's like, let me go and be happy and let her be happy. She can have, you know, maybe she's right about some of that stuff that I said, whatever, you know, go be happy. For him to be the way he was, it was like, that just was like, that threw me off. And so that's why I can't really call her crazy. I think they both were crazy. You know, they both were just in like battle rage.
Yeah. Because I think you know, Isaac mentioned Danny DeVito's advice. If you look back at that, his advice, you know, sell the house, it takes the competition out of the game.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It takes the competitive element out of this really difficult situation.
Yeah.
Right.
Nobody wins.
Right.
So look, I got to ask the question. Do you all think that this is actually a strange love? Because I don't think there was anything strange about this.
This is your everyday art?
Beyond. Well, I'm saying because, you know, we've all seen examples, be it personal experience or, you know, reading about it on Twitter, where people who seemingly were so in love with each other at the beginning have become complete, you know, enemies to each other, you know, at the end. And the pattern, they're probably a series of patterns, but they're all probably follow the same track of what you walked into was a vision, you know what I'm saying, of what you wanted. And then once reality kicked in, then you realized that you either weren't going to tolerate it. Because I mean, I absolutely believe in love, but there's a degree to a successful marriage, which is tolerance. What are you willing to tolerate from this other person whom you initially say and then find out you actually really do, you know what I mean, love?
I do find it a bit strange.
Okay.
I just, not so much that, I think all the dynamics, I think everything you just said, I absolutely agree with, but I find it strange that your ego is so incredibly tied to being right. Like, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? And the reality of just like, even if you've lost respect, somebody pisses you off and all this other stuff, to be so rooted in, I have to hurt this person, as opposed to you could have your peace if you would just walk out the fucking door.
And you're speaking of Michael Douglas.
Michael
character.
Or her, like, leave, get another house. Yeah, okay. I know you're attached to this house. I get loving a house, but where's your peace? Like, you know what I mean? At the end of the day, it's just like people and their egos and the battles and the battles and the battles. It's like, for what?
Did you, Aiko, though, did you sympathize more with her, though, in that, just in the,
absolutely,
in the context of keeping the house? Because really, that's, I mean, she did pour everything in that house, and then he basically was like,
100%. But, you know, mm-hmm. I'm also one of those people, I love homes, love the HGTV shit and stuff like that. And because I've seen House Hunters mm-hmm. a million times, guess what? I can find another house. I just, yeah. I can't imagine, like, I mean, I can't imagine it. And it's like, and it's not that I don't have empathy or compassion for how people get in these situations in their relationships. I totally understand it. Everybody has had some form of a fucked up whatever in their relationships. That's mm-hmm. not the point. It's just the point that where it went with them and how far it went. I find that strange and a toxic behavior because it's continuing and there's no self-awareness or there's nobody's willing to back down. And that's all ego. Like, for what? Like, to be that?
They were really like the same person.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but once things reach this kind of fever pitch and the momentum takes on a life of its own.
Yes.
To quote my man Mark Strong in 1917, some guys just like the fight.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, these situations can get so bad that people just forget what they're fighting for.
Mm.
I got that from, I think that's definitely apropos to Douglas's character. Like, he just, you know, because he was an attorney. And it was like, I think that when she brought, when she, you know, provoked his ire, he basically was like, all right, you want to tussle, let's tussle, you know. And it was like, it ramped up from there. But I think, to answer Arthur's question, I think this was strange. I didn't find this love, though. I think she fell out of love with him, you know, which is her right. Like Jay said, that's her right. I don't think he ever really understood, or maybe he lost it over the years. Maybe he did love her initially. But I think he fell out of love with her at some point as well. Not because in the same way as she fell out of love with him, but mainly because he lost sight of her, you know, and who she really was and so on and so forth. And then, so to me, it wasn't by the last, you know, half hour, 45 minutes of the movie, it wasn't two people in love fighting. It was just two people who were not in love with each other.
So in thinking about that, how many films before had we seen, obviously we've seen films where couples go at it. What's the one that one, the two of them are drinking?
I was just about to ask if any films have done this better.
Days of Wine and Roses. Is it Elizabeth Taylor that's in it?
I don't think Elizabeth Taylor's in that. I'm looking it up. It's the Lee Remick is in it with Jack Lemmon.
Okay, there you go. See? But that, like, there are some films that do it, but I think the thing about War of the Roses, I can't say I have, but I'm sure you guys can give me some examples. I don't know too many mainstream films that people had seen that people were in a physical, like you actually saw them squab.
You know, are you thinking of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Well, that's another one. But there's some nasty fight scenes.
Because she's off the chain in that
one. Oh, she's off the chain. And yes, that's another one where they're just like, you know, the gloves are off. But I don't know if audiences had really seen people physically attacking one another, even though it's a dramedy. And yes, tonally, maybe they could have actually made the violence more like Tom and Jerry. Maybe it doesn't really work with people the way it would work with cartoons. But I understand why it didn't work for you, Isaac, but maybe for an audience in 1989 seeing it, it was just like, oh shit.
Yeah. The other movie that is different, but it's a better, well, it's a better Danny DeVito vehicle in terms of how the comedy is related to the irony of the situation, is Ruthless People, Bette Midler.
Oh yeah.
It's basically about a guy who doesn't love his wife anymore. She's really, really, I mean, she takes a lot of work, right? And then she get, and because he's this prominent, I think he's like a fashion mogul or something like that, you know, to this couple, man and woman, like the young couple, kidnap the wife. And DeVito's like, thank you. And so he refuses to pay the ransom. He tries to avoid the kidnapper's calls. The kidnapper can't figure it. They can't figure it out. Why doesn't he love this woman? And then Bette Midler, they realize that, you know, she's a piece of work. So it's like, it becomes a thing where they just try to get rid of her. It becomes a hot potato thing. And from a comedy standpoint, it worked a lot better than War of the Roses. And I kind of felt, I think Ruthless People was done 85, 86. I feel it was done after Romancing the Stone. But it's like, it feels like War of the Roses tried to inject that same level of ironic comedy, but the situation, two people fighting each other in a bitter divorce with the house being the object of their struggle, just didn't work.
Yeah.
As well as the irony of these kidnappers basically, you know, helped this guy, gave him his best, you know, the wish he never wished for in terms of not dealing. Because there was a reason why he didn't want to divorce the wife, or he couldn't, or something like that. But there was a reason behind that. But I think, yes, those two movies were really, they just came to mind for me.
Well, I really like The War of the Roses. It makes me wonder, your three reactions to this movie. It makes me wonder whether I dug the comedy more because of the performances than the script itself. I think, Arthur, to answer your question, films that do it better, I think different maybe is my preferred term for it. Kramer versus Kramer very
100%.
Obviously covers this area quite well. But another film I want to shine a light on that I don't think enough people have seen or are even aware of is an independent movie called The Killing of Two Lovers. It stars Clayne Crawford of Lethal Weapon TV series fame, who I think is actually a very strong actor. It's a very short movie, a deceptively simple movie. It's got one of the best opening frames that I've seen in recent times. It's sort of an indelible image, actually. And it's hard for me to think of a film about the disintegration of a marriage that really shows the pain of what somebody can go through, the desperation of what someone can go through. I thought it was a very strong movie. I recommend it. But I think The War of the Roses did everything very well. And by everything, actually, you know, I saw this movie, I've seen it twice. I saw it on its first release, and I actually saw it in a different language. So I think there's lots of things I didn't pick up until I saw it again. And with a little bit more maturity, etc. Something that really, really struck me is that it's wonderfully directed, in my opinion, and it's beautifully photographed. So I think Danny DeVito did a wonderful job, but the director of photography is a guy called Stephen Burnham, and he worked with Brian De Palma quite a lot. And it's interesting because there's a particular thing in The War of the Roses, a particular shot where two characters are in the frame at the same time, and one's in very, very close focus and the other's in sort of distant focus. And De Palma does that a lot too. So I wonder whether De Palma got it from Stephen Burnham and Stephen Burnham then, you know, gave it to Danny DeVito too. But either way, I think the colors are beautiful. They're very warm, especially the sequence when, I mean, the warm throughout the movie, but the sequence that I love the most is when Douglas is in hospital and his journey back from hospital on the train. The lighting, the warmth, the glow, it's just right up my alley. I mean, I'm not saying it's Chinatown, but it's you know, it's got something. Oh, and the way that Kathleen Turner especially is lit, her face.
Yeah.
There's such a lovely glow, particularly around her eyes. It's not like a kind of high contrast noir thing, but like, I mean, I'm not an expert, but I felt that there was a kind of classic lighting to her face that was, you know, a little bit reminiscent of a bygone era. I thought it was beautiful.
Yeah.
Favorite egg, just really randomly, one of my favorite, maybe my favorite line in the movie, classic Danny DeVito, when she says, you know, something about when Kathleen Turner is trying to seduce him, which, by the way, was way out of pocket. On it just is, if we're like keeping, if we're keeping tabs of like who did some crazy shit, her trying to sleep with his lawyer, come on, that's one of, that was like, wow. Because I thought that was going to be like a trick, like she was trying to, no, she was trying to sleep with this dude to, you know, I was like, wow, that's crazy. But my favorite was when she was like something about, you know, you, I heard you like to, or something about, don't you like to make love angrily? And DeVito says, yes. Is there any other way?
Exactly.
And the way he delivers it, classic Danny DeVito. That was the one moment in the movie I laughed out loud. I was like, that motherfucker right there.
Something that made me laugh out loud when I saw it, and I don't know if this is intentional, but when they both turn up the heat on each other, both literally and figuratively, and they're both kind of like drenched in sweat, Kathleen Turner looks fantastic. She looks like a vision.
Yes, she does.
You know, she's really glowing. And Douglas looks like some maniac pirate.
Listen, my favorite is when they're both in, they're in bed. It's after his a faux heart attack. He's asleep. She's awake. She's irritated. So to wake him up, she takes two fingers and sticks them both up his nostrils.
She was mad. She was
done. Awesome. I want to talk.
Yeah. I want to
say too, Jahan, one other film that, yeah, when you were talking about The Killing of Two Lovers, just without going into too much detail about it, but another film that shows like a man holding on and the heartbreak around that, like where you actually felt for him more, was Blue Valentine. Blue Valentine, that shit, like I fell for that dude. I was like, she's done. And he really was holding on to thinking that they could, this relationship could be salvaged. Like, you know what I mean? He deeply loved her, but it was just.
What are some of you guys' favorite warring couples outside of just divorce, like television, film, books, whatever? What is some of your, like your favorite warring couples, like couples who, you know, just knocking heads. They're passionately in love, but they're just like going at it and trying to hurt
the
each
Costanzas.
Other.
The Costanzas.
Which one?
The Costanzas. George Costanza's parents. But listen, to close this out, can any of us relate to this situation?
Can definitely relate on the family level. Relationship-wise, maybe when I was a teenager, just because of what I'd seen modeled, but I, you know, for me, I don't like feeling like I'm in a constant state of IBS. So if some shit happens in relationships, it just doesn't feel good. I'm just like, I gotta go. Like, I don't hold on to shit. Like, no, 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 no. I don't like ugly because like the world is ugly enough. So if it's happening in my home or in my personal life, like, bye. Like, you know what I mean? And it might take me a minute to get there when I realize like, oh shit, like this is not gonna keep going. But I don't really like drama like that. It's just, it's, you can't sleep, you know, you don't feel good. It's constantly like just that agitation. Like if it's, cause I am a little crazy, like I will want to be, if it gets to that point, I will want to feel physical. So instead of me blowing up in that way, I would rather just leave and save the physical for like, you know, The Walking Dead or when you actually need to go to war with somebody for real.
When the apocalypse comes.
Yeah, exactly.
I would hit you, but I'm waiting for the apocalypse.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'll just say, you know what, I would just say to repeat what I said earlier is that I think many people are surprised what you do or what you're capable of doing when you're in like mortal emotional pain.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's true. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. But just to repeat what I said earlier, it just surprised me, Michael Douglas's character at his age, that he had not. And maybe it's because he had lived in his own cocoon of, you know, going to work, making the money and, you know, creating this, what he thought should be their life, you know, in his mind for all those decades. But, you know, the way he behaved, you know, again, I completely, you know, understand how he behaved in the lawyer's office, but the way he behaved subsequently, it just surprised me because I'm like, dude, you should be mature enough or have lived enough to know it ain't worth it.
Should.
You know, and you should walk away from this.
Should. But we see examples like a grown ass people acting a plum fool. Like, you would hope that people would get to a certain point and have a certain maturity level, some world, you know, a worldview that could shape them being an emotionally mature adult. But people are fucking nuts. And we see it every day.
And it's getting worse, right? Especially with social media. You know, we're breeding this mentality where everybody's on 10 all the time and everybody's tribal. And I mean, I despise it. Yeah. Everybody's got their own camp. And as long as your camp says something, it's right. Mm-hmm. As long as the other guy's camp says something, it's wrong. And there's absolutely no incentive to reflect on it. No incentive to ever come back and say, oh, you know, maybe I call that one wrong.
Yeah.
We see it so much. I think it bleeds into real life now more than ever. I mean, something about the War of the Roses, Douglas's character, he actually didn't have a tribe. He didn't have a cheerleading squad. You know, weren't any real friends in the frame telling him that he was doing the right thing. Not his lawyer, not his family.
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting point. And I think just before you close, Arthur, just I think because we haven't talked about this.
I mean, he didn't need any egging on.
Yeah,
it was him.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the kitchen scene, he's not doing it for likes. He's his own fan base.
That was also a classic Michael Douglas, like just in a crazy, I mean, I don't know. He's just a very, very unique and idiosyncratic, you know, actor. Because it's like, I couldn't see anybody else there and I would laugh the same way I laughed when I saw him there.
It's true.
But it's an interesting point you make though, because I think culturally speaking, I go back to that scene at the earlier in the film when they were having a dinner and all his superiors were there. And it was very Masters of the Universe, you know, white attorneys, you know, almost Wall Street-esque.
Yes,
you know,
yeah.
Is the vibe I got from that. And so he's lived in that world. And so that kind of came back later when he, even after she made him believe that he was eating his own dog.
Yeah.
He still was like, you know, we can work this out. You know, there was still a sense of him that felt like this is my world. I can still shape this the way I want. Mm-hmm. I can still manage this. It was a denial, a deep seated denial in him. And I think one of you guys mentioned it earlier of not knowing, not being aware of what's really happening because it was like, it's his world.
Yeah.
And it was like, I just think it's, you know, I think it's because nobody else is going to talk, has talked about this, but. So maybe we should, but from a cultural standpoint, I think that comes into play. His living in that white world of white male world of dominance, where it is my way. You know, this is my world. I can shape this. I can do whatever I want. I've got the money, the power. Mm-hmm. That came into play. So when Jay, like what you said, which I think was an excellent point, like he ostensibly didn't have any cheerleaders, but it was like his whole world was his cheerleader.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It was like his whole world view supported what he was doing.
Yes.
I don't know if I can agree with you, Isaac, on the facts, because the sort of two characters, the two male characters in Douglas's world, DeVito, his colleague, and then his senior partner, his managing partner, you know, they both, I mean, when he pulls out the floor plan for the house and he shows it to DeVito as if it's a masterstroke, and, you know, another great line, I've got more square footage.
they're magical together. They are magical together.
And DeVito asks him straight, and this seems rational to you? He's dismayed. And the managing partner, you know, when he comes into Douglas's office, he says, look, is everything okay? Do you need some time off? Do you need to, you know, do you need to step away from everything? He can see that Douglas is unraveling, and he's not being egged on by anybody. So, I mean, I agree, you know, maybe philosophically with you on your point about that world, etc., but certainly in this movie, on the facts, I think it's a bit different.
You know, the children and also the subdivision of the house, that's actually what I closely relate to. Because I my parents divorced when I was 2, maybe 3. I really don't know. But my mother remarried, and my stepfather at the time, who was a very influential figure in my life, things to where there's stuff that today, you know, is basically from the influence of this man, you know, and they got a divorce, and it got to a point where the house was almost zoned, you know, and, you know, we were regulated to rooms, and the tension was so thick, and me at the time being 13 going on 14, I think I was old enough to have some understanding of what was happening, but too young to really have any kind of power in the dynamic, you know. It really, I think that the children, the son and the daughter, I know Sean Astin plays the son, I forget who plays the daughter, but, you know, the two children sort of being disconnected, I think that was done intentionally, because when you sort of bring the child emotional component to it, it becomes a completely different movie. And since this comes out post Breakfast Club, where you've got these teenagers and they manifest this angst, the children's voices about the angst of their family and their parents, made it a little easier to kind of disassociate the children, where it's like, yeah, mom and dad are just nuts, you know, and the children are just sort of like on the same page, but out of the picture in that way.
But I was going to say, like with Arthur too, like I definitely can relate to this. I had the parents that, you know, were definitely them in the physical form, and the big thing of contention were the records and the divorce. Till this day, my dad is still hot over the fact that my mom took the records. It like all, every now and again, it'll just flare up out of nowhere. You motherfucker got my records. And I'm like, oh, like,
that's real,
you
though.
Guys have been
that's
divorced. Real, though. It's real. Divorced for decades, but still talks about them records like it was yesterday. And I understand, like, they were huge music lovers, but it was like she knew it would piss him off. And he just, like, the two of them, man. So she took all the music, and he hasn't been right since.
Because I'm on my second marriage, and we've been married for going on 18 years, which is actually a positive result of what I've seen growing
exactly.
up.
Exactly.
You know, but my first marriage, which was much shorter at much younger age, she's got CDs. She's got my Vanity 6 original Warner Brothers CD that you just can't get anymore. And I'm like, you don't like them. You've never liked them.
Is it from Japan? Was it Japanese, Arthur?
You know it was. You know it was. I was mad as hell. I'm still upset about that. All right, let me call a full lid on this episode of Snobs on Film. I want to thank Aiko, Isaac, and Jahan joining me for this episode where we discuss 1989's War of the Roses. My name is Arthur, your host. And please follow us on Twitter at Snobs on Film. We would love to hear your thoughts on War of the Roses, and maybe even your personal anecdotes of your experiences or anything that we've talked about. We're doing one theme and 10 films this season, Strange Love. You can tag your comment with the hashtag one theme, 10 films. And we've got 7 more films to go, where we're going to continue to examine each film through the lens of Strange Love. Could be selfish, could be complicated, could be turned to hate like this one was, or just plain wrong. See you next show.